I have testified before the Congress for 3 years that, in my judgment, the odds are today that if we had to have a conventional war with the Soviet Union, they could cut those sea lines. And in my judgment, the odds are that we could not keep those sea lines open. Now, the way in which that judgment is made is, in my view, based on much more analytical view and examination of the detail than is made by those who march in and blithely suggest that we will have a tough time and lose a lot of ships, but if the Congress will pass the budget, we can probably hack it. We do extensive analyses. We do war games. The results are pessimistic. When one examines the results of the fleet exercises in which we try to recreate segments or all of those war games, the results are even more pessimistic. When one examines the terrible state of readiness of our forces due to lack of adequate funding of spare parts and supplies, the picture is even gloomier. There is, in my mind, no doubt about the judgment that today we cannot, the odds are, control and use the seas. Now, let me examine for you a couple of the crises with which I had to deal during the 4 years that I was the Chief of Naval Operations in the light of that dramatically shifting military balance, which incidentally was accelerated as a result of the fact that we let ourselves get bogged down fighting in the costliest possible way a Southeast Asia war in which the Soviet Union, for the expenditure of never more than $3 billion per year, was able to drive us up to the level of $30 billion per year for bombs and bullets and attrition aircraft and operating expenses while they were making capital improvements. The first of these crises was the Jordan crisis of September 1970. You'll recall that the Soviet Union, this nation with whom we are engaged in detente, had made the conscious policy decision to try to keep open the wound in the Middle East by arming and training the Arabs. And by September of 1970, as they examined the strategic program and the maritime construction program and concluded that in their judgment they were probably ahead, they felt it was time to conduct a nice, safe probe. The Syrian tank armies invaded Jordan. Three things went wrong with the calculation. First, the Jordanian army fought better than had been calculated. Second, the Israelis moved their forces northward and were clearly ready to play a role. Third, the United States reinforced its 6th Fleet with a 3rd Carrier Task Force. We had 24 just 3 years before that, and we were down to 15, and we will head for 12. And with Marines embarked upon USS Guam, the amphibious ship with helicopters, and that calculus of factors led the Syrians and the Soviets to conclude with regard to that probe, not yet. The Syrians were promised that their losses would be replaced, and they were. And the continuing provision of equipment to the Egyptians and the Syrians went forward. They were trained better in the art of strategic surprise. By October of 1973, they were ready. They initiated on Yom Kippur Day a strike against Israel, a strike conducted so skillfully that it fooled not only Israeli intelligence but our own. And Israel was very nearly overrun. Only the massive airlift of supplies in that much maligned C-5A aircraft made it possible for the situation to be turned around. And only by brutalizing one of our allies, Portugal, into providing the Azores airfield was it possible for that airlift to get there. With the change in the Portuguese regime, in my judgment, next time Portugal, like all the rest of our NATO allies, will stand aside in that kind of a bilateral crunch, and airlift will not be able to get there unless the Congress has made it possible for us to use the backdoor route by the provision of Diego Garcia, something that the Congress continues to refuse to do. Now, I say we turned the situation around for the Israelis. As we were doing so, scrambling to get the maximum number of ships we could get there from our rapidly diminishing fleet, we had 65 in the Eastern Mediterranean. They faced 98 Soviet vessels, a 50% advantage. Those who are against more defense will point out immediately that there were three aircraft carriers there and that the Soviets didn't yet have their first one operational. That's true. You will live to see the Soviets with a larger aircraft carrier fleet than we have as we continue to reduce ours and they continue to build theirs. But notwithstanding that fact, those three aircraft carriers and 65 ships were surrounded by the prospect that Soviet aircraft could be flown at them from four different axes of attack: Egypt, Syria, Crimea, and Yugoslavia. And we had not a single Allied airfield, and therefore not a single U.S. Air Force airplane or Allied airplane that could come to the assistance of our ships. And therefore, I know of no knowledgeable expert at the time who disagreed with my judgment that had we had to go to war with the Soviet Union in the Eastern Mediterranean, we would have been defeated, the odds are. And so, when the Soviet Union sent its ultimatum, addressed not to dear Mr. President, but just Mr. President, an ultimatum which said, you should call off the Israelis from the Egyptian Third Army, or we will have to go in together, or in that event, we would have to, if you do not, we would have to consider going in by ourselves. An ultimatum, in my judgment, every bit as brutal as the one we sent them in the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I helped to draft. We had, quite apart from the political considerations, in my judgment, no rational military alternative than to agree to call off the Israelis. We did so. We went on an alert, sure. We helped to fuzz it up, just as we worked with the Soviets 12 years earlier to fuzz up their back down. But let's face it, they outpointed us in military capability, and we had no rational alternative. Now, what are the lessons from this? Does this suggest that we're headed for a strategic nuclear war? In my judgment, the odds are very high that we are not. Does it mean that we are headed for a conventional war with the Soviet Union? In my judgment, again, the odds, although not so high, are still fairly high that we are not. The Soviet Union, in contrast to our conventional wisdom, which suggests that we won a great foreign policy victory in the Yom Kippur War, the Soviets being out of Egypt and the Syrians tilting slightly toward us, the Soviet Union is exultant, I think it is quite clear, with the outcome. Their long-term objective of reopening the Suez Canal has been achieved. Their long-term policy direction of getting an oil embargo came to pass, followed by the quadrupling of the oil prices. They are delirious with expectation over the prospect of a billion people in 30 nations facing starvation as the result of those oil price increases. And they are delighted with what they see in the so-called prosperous free world, which is flirting with everything from a radical solution in the case of Italy and Portugal to getting ready to make additional massive cuts in the defense budget in the case of the United States as its newly elected Congress proceeds to wield the axe. This, in my judgment, is the nature of the future you face. Just as during the last 25 years, whenever this freedom-loving but stability-loving country of ours felt that its national vital interests were at stake and marshaled its forces and the Soviet Union accommodated, we, in the decade ahead, must be the ones prepared to accommodate. And we can expect the Soviets to be very careful, very rational. They monitor us through their Arbatov Institute and through Ambassador Dobrynin, whose embassy personnel funnel out through our executive and congressional branches daily. Better than a doctor monitors the fever chart of his patient. They know when the natives are beginning to get sullen, and they will watch to see when we begin to get mutinous. And at that point, the word will go back out, cool it, fellas. In my judgment, all it takes to begin to turn this around is for the Congress to begin to add to the President's defense budgets instead of to subtract. The mere sending of that signal will be the peak on the fever chart that sends the signal back to Moscow. Cool it, fellas. Slow your five-year plan down to 15 years. Slow down the economic warfare. Make it possible for that billion people to get a little food. It is a brilliant display of the use of military superiority for aggressive foreign policy gains, and it is up to the American people through its elected representatives to do something about it if we expect our way of life to be able to survive against this economic warfare. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm ready for your questions. The question is, do other military feel the same as I about the military balance? In my judgment, the large majority of military personnel who have had the opportunity to examine the studies and the fleet exercises, the war games, feel as I do. Yes, sir. You're referring to the use of weapons or to... Well, yes. Well, I share the view that nuclear weapons are fearsome things to use, and I share the prayers of all of us that they will never be used. I believe that the United States has made efforts above and beyond the call of reason to try to negotiate fair arms control arrangements which would make it possible to reduce expenditures in this field. Indeed, the United States unilaterally has reduced expenditures in the strategic field, and for the last 5 years has been spending at one-third of the rate of the previous 10, while the Soviet Union has soared ahead of us and has been outspending us in the strategic field by 60%. The problem that we face is that the Soviet Union insists upon superiority and insists upon being able to use that superiority. How do they use it? They use it in the following way. They tell our allies and their own that they have nuclear superiority. Our own allies believe they have it. They tell me that they believe they have it. It's like gold at Fort Knox. You never have to use it. My associates in overseas military services and their ministers of defense have said to me that they see daily shifts in the sentiment of their people and their parliaments saying, Moscow is the wave of the future. Let's seek rapprochement with Moscow and disaffiliate with Washington. It is like a mosaic turning daily and slowly in the direction of the Soviets under the umbrella of their strategic superiority, which they believe they will never have to use. I believe all right, I'll give you a brief answer. My view of the problem is the following one. Regardless of right or wrong in South Vietnam, and I happen to have been one of those who opposed going in, we have, as a nation, given our sacred honor to the 17 million people of South Vietnam who cast their lot with us, that in exchange for a very bad truce, which permitted the North to remain in the jungles in the South, that we would continue to provide aid to them. I do not believe that this country can survive as a free and democratic and viable society if it fails to honor that commitment. Similarly, Similarly, this country gave a commitment at the end of World War II to the State of Israel. Under pressure, in the face of Soviet military superiority, if we cast that baby out of the sled like a baby to the wolves, I think this country will have lost the essence of what its national life is all about. The media in general tend to be of the school that believes that we're not in trouble with regard to defense. I think that those who are worried about our defense among the media are in the minority. But I think that the basic problem is the failure of leadership to say what the facts are. It isn't enough for a military man to get up and say it. It's got to be the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and the President of the United States before the American people are really going to hear about it through the media. Responsibilities of an organization of the principles of this one is to try to get that word out to the people. Each year, when I was in office, I tried to talk to every member of the Congress. I averaged 85 of the 100 senators, and I averaged 350 of the 435 representatives. I found that they broke down roughly into thirds. There was roughly a third that each year said, "We agree 100%, we're as worried as you are, and we'll vote for you." There was roughly a third that would turn off the switch when you walked in and didn't even want to understand the problem. And then there was a middle third that would say things like, "Admiral, we agree and understand, but if we vote for you, we'll lose our seat, and then what good will we be to you?" So within that group, there was a subset that would say, "Look, I've got to show a 30% record on defense to my constituents. You tell me which 30% to vote for, and I'll vote for you." And that group, however immoral, was useful because you could cast their votes against you when you had it made and save their 30% for the close ones. But until we turn the American people around, we're not going to change that middle third. And until we can get to the American people, they're not going to turn around. There's no doubt in my mind that the American people do not want to be inferior, but they don't know that we are. I think not, but I think that for the media to be brought around, leadership has got to state what the facts are. Yes? Oh, yes, it was part of the face-saving arrangement that was given the Soviets. They having agreed to remove their missiles, the United States agreed to a pledge not to invade, which has been honored ever since, as the Soviets have proceeded to violate their half of the agreement by increasingly nibbling away at the use of Cuba for bases. Yes?
I presume that you're aware of Dr. Sutton's studies on Western technology and Soviet economic development. My question is, what is your attitude toward American businesses that are building up the industrial might of the Soviet Union with Commerce Department sanction?
First, I believe in detente. Second, I believe that detente will only work if the United States maintains the military strength to make it work. Third, I believe that we have got to use trade and technology as part of the pile of blue chips that we put on the table to ensure that this communist dictatorship, which has half our gross national product, grants us strategic parity rather than insisting on having strategic superiority, and that we also insist that they not outbuild us in the maritime field, which has traditionally been the way that we could reassure our allies we could reinforce. In other words, I believe that the whole ball of wax involved in détente should be put on the table, and the United States should be prepared to walk away from it if the Soviets don't practice the kind of détente in which we believe and continue to insist upon their version of differentiated détente, meaning they will behave where they have to and they will misbehave wherever they can get away with it.
One more question, Admiral.
The gentleman speakers ago brought the media, brought focus on the media. And in answering his question, you said the people in the media seem to not believe there's any problem with defense and have acted from that position of belief. Now, my question is twofold. One is, what on earth gives them that notion, since the facts seem to be completely otherwise? And second, thinking as they do they have the right to spread their view of the military status of things rather than seek to deliver the facts? What I'm talking about really is media display of bias or prejudice in this particular aspect.
Well, let's be very clear. To date, no President of the United States and no Secretary of Defense and no Secretary of State has stood up and said the United States is behind. Until they do, the media, in my judgment, has the right to assume that that leadership is accurate. I think the problem begins with leadership.
Speaking of...